The following program is not a production of Audio Journal. External programs like this are selected with the interests of our audience in mind and with the goal to inform and entertain. The opinions expressed in this program do not reflect the views and opinions of Audio Journal, its board of directors, staff, or volunteer readers. Thank you for listening to Audio Journal.
Hello, and welcome to the Women's Hour. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. Beginning with Upworthy. Her landlord evicted her after 7 years. She took her entire garden with her on the way out. By Adam Albright Hanna. When she was 18, a woman signed a lease on a house that wasn't much to look at. The backyard was bare dirt with a fence around it. But it was cheap, and it had space, which was exactly what she wanted. Over the next 7 years, she built something. A greenhouse, a garden shed, a pizza oven, raised vegetable beds in transportable containers, an aquaponics setup, pavers, the kind of backyard that became the place all her friends wanted to gather. It became the green oasis all my friends gathered at, she wrote on Reddit. Then her landlords decided to sell the house and asked her to leave. So she did, and she took her garden with her. Nothing in my last backyard was directly planted into the ground, and nothing was permanent, she explained. She dismantled the shed and greenhouse, loaded every pot and garden bed onto a truck, and cleared the space in 3 days. The backyard was returned to the same state she'd found it in 7 years earlier. Bare dirt with a fence. Her landlords were furious. It turns out they'd already listed the property for sale, using photos of her garden, and buyers were walking away when they showed up and found an empty lot instead. They accused her of stealing their plants and wrecking the property. She hadn't broken any rules. Her contract said she could garden. She had photos from the original walkthrough showing the backyard in its pre-garden state. The same real estate agent who'd done her initial inspection signed off on her move-out, and she got her full deposit back. "Legally, I'm fine," she wrote. But she was still wondering if she'd done something wrong. Reddit answered that question pretty quickly. This is a classic story of a landlord trying to benefit from home improvements paid for by the tenant, one person wrote. If your landlord was honest, he would have asked you how much you wanted to leave the garden as it was. You owe him nothing. Someone else shared a similar experience where their landlord actually paid them to leave their balcony improvements behind. I set my price and was literally paid to move out. Win-win all around. The landlord's argument was essentially that her years of unpaid labor and personal investment had become their property the moment they decided to sell. The woman's argument was that she'd rented a dirt lot, improved it entirely at her own expense, with fully transportable setups, and took her stuff with her when she left. The survey data sides with the landlords on one point. Research cited by the Virginia Cooperative Extension shows that well-maintained landscaping can raise a home's perceived value by 10 to 12%. buyers do make strong first impressions from a property's exterior. But there's a difference between landscaping that belongs to a property and a greenhouse someone built herself and loaded onto a truck. She knew the difference. Her contract knew the difference. The real estate agent knew the difference. The landlords just hadn't thought about it until the buyers started walking away. From the Boston Globe. In her time, Marilyn Monroe was sex on a piece of film. Now she's something more. By Noah Eisenberg. Anyone who's ever seen Marilyn Monroe as Sugar Kane Kowalczyk making her grand entrance at a Chicago train station in Billy Wilder's Some Like It Hot, 1959, dressed in a form-fitting black skirt, frilly overcoat, and flapper hat, carrying a ukulele in one hand and a small boxy suitcase in the other, likely still holds that indelible image mostly intact. As Sugar saunters by, a burst of steam shoots out from the Florida Limited, tickling her nether regions and giving a nod to an iconic scene from an earlier picture, also directed by Wilder and starring Monroe. Billowy white dress, perilously close to wardrobe malfunction, as she's perched above a New York City subway grate in 1955's The 7-Year Itch. Ever since she first appeared on screen, Monroe, who would have turned 100 on June 1st, has titillated audiences across the globe. A famous nude, taken when the young Norma Jean Mortensen hadn't yet been dubbed Marilyn Monroe, appeared in countless pinup calendars and was later repurposed as Playboy's first centerfold. In her screen test at 20th Century Fox in summer 1946, Leon Shamroy, who shot the test, said that she was like sex on a piece of film. Wilder himself spoke of flesh impact to describe the phenomenon. You swear when she was on screen that if you reached up and touched it, you'd touch flesh, he said in a 1989 interview in these pages. Nobody else had that, not even Garbo. But despite her tantalizing luminescence, her unique mix of childlike innocence and erotic knowingness, Monroe herself vehemently rejected the idea of being a sex symbol. In her final interview with Life reporter Richard Merriman, given a month before her death from a barbiturate overdose in August 1962, at the age of 36, she observed, "That's the trouble. A sex symbol becomes a thing. I just hate to be a thing." The other thing she hated was being typecast as the seductive yet patently dumb blonde. "I can be smart when it's important," she remarks as showgirl Lorelei Lee in 1953's Gentlemen Prefer Blondes, "but most men don't like it." Even in 1957's The Prince and the Showgirl, produced by her own company, Marilyn Monroe Productions, her co-star and the film's director, Laurence Olivier, offered a piece of advice that reflected the dominant chauvinist view of her time. All you have to do is be sexy, dear Marilyn. But now, at the Monroe Centennial, those views no longer hold. Artists as diverse as Madonna, Beyoncé, Britney Spears, and Jennifer Lopez have played with Monroe's legacy as a sex symbol or cultural obsession. Their homages to the blonde bombshell, however, transcend mere sex appeal by recognizing Monroe's outsized talent and artistic singularity. Mariah Carey, whose infatuation with Monroe began in childhood, not only purchased the actress's white baby piano at an auction at Christie's in the 1990s, but in 2022 joined the producing team behind the successful Broadway musical of Some Like It Hot. A more generous spirit of recognition and a desire to rewrite the dominant narrative continues to define various tributes to Monroe in honor of her 100th birthday. At the Cinémathèque Française in Paris, the Monroe exhibition, which runs through the end of July, aims at restoring the image of an actress who was too often mocked and disparaged. It emphasizes Monroe's fight for independence and her struggle to control her own image. In a similar vein, a summer retrospective of her work at London's British Film Institute, Marilyn Monroe, Self-Made Star, will run concurrently with a photo exhibit of the star at the National Portrait Gallery. Here in the United States, the Museum of Modern Art's Film Department just concluded its Marilyn Monroe Celluloid Dream program, and the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures in Los Angeles has launched its full-scale Marilyn Monroe Hollywood Icon exhibition. Both are bold attempts to present a fuller, more judicious account of the screen siren, jettisoning some of the tired clichés for fresh reappraisal. These same efforts have carried over into a bevy of publications planned to coincide with the centennial celebrations. Among them are a new photo collection, the Marilyn Monroe Century, From Norma Jean to Icon, by the photographer Bruno Bernard, who took the famous photo above the New York subway grate, and Marilyn, The Lost Photographs, The Last Interview, which features the remarkably candid life interview by Merriman and photos of Monroe inside her Brentwood home by Alan Grant. Perhaps most of all, the British scholar Gail Crowther, in Marilyn and Her Books, turns our attention neither to the star's sex appeal nor to the well-worn tales of woe, but instead to the largely unknown reading habits of an intellectually curious, if often insecure, autodidact, and her extraordinary book collection. Taken together, the events and publications commemorating the Monroe Centennial clearly mark a concerted effort to mount a major corrective. "We've come a long way," British Film Institute lead programmer Kimberly Sheehan recently said, "but there's still further to go. If Marilyn was around today, she could have been a Margot Robbie, someone with huge capital in her image, but also a terrific performer and a smart, active producer." The truth is, Monroe was the Margot Robbie of her day, a smart, savvy actress who paved the way for those who came after her. She was always far more a trailblazer than a Hollywood tragedy. From Yahoo Life. They were tired of being asked what's for dinner every night, so they got a food divorce. What do you gain when you stop making dinner for everyone? By Rachel Grumman Bender. Kathleen Donahoe was tired of cooking. Like many people raising kids with a spouse, she'd faced the same question every night. What's for dinner? The Seattle mom of two, who recently finished her first novel, After They Drowned, eventually realized she no longer wanted to be responsible for the answer. She hadn't planned to be the primary cook in her marriage. I was a woman's studies major in college, she tells Yahoo. But her husband worked outside the house for 13 hours a day, while she worked from home, so dinner mainly defaulted to her. Donahoe threw herself into the task, however, spending countless Sundays meal planning for the week ahead and chasing an idealized version of dinner, carefully following a recipe, making sure there was always a vegetable on her kids' plates, and trying to recreate the meals pictured in glossy cookbooks. When the pandemic hit, that made things much harder. With her kids at home because of school closures, she went from making one meal a day to five, including snacks. The breaking point was way too many dinners that were miserable, she says. So Donahoe did something different. She stopped cooking during the week. There's even a name for this shift: food divorce, when people, mostly women, decide they don't want to be the household's primary meal maker anymore. Or, as Donahoe puts it, I broke up with cooking. Instead of making dinners from scratch, she relies on Trader Joe's frozen meals and assembles simple dinners for her family. It's okay for me to just open the fridge at 5 o'clock and I will find something that my kids will eat, she says. It can be a grilled cheese, and that's okay. She still cooks occasionally, but it's on her own terms. On weekends, her family hosts a casual Sunday supper, inviting other families over for low-stress dinners where they can serve themselves, like a pasta or baked potato bar. For Donahoe's family, the new routine worked almost immediately. By stepping back from cooking every night, Donahoe says her family gained something in return: more joy and more time together outside the kitchen. Putting a quesadilla in front of my family makes everyone happy, she says. Somehow, dinner not being about the food is what my family, at this season of our life, really needs. Dinner duty burnout is real. In many households, the responsibility for getting dinner on the table, meal planning, grocery shopping, and cooking largely falls on one person. For some families, that arrangement works well. For others, it can lead to burnout and even resentment. A March 2026 Yahoo YouGov poll of 1,699 U.S. adults found that 16% said they often feel resentful about how cooking duties are divided in their household. And 11% shared that they have refused to cook to make a point. Psychologist Ann Welsh, who is also a working mom of four, is seeing more and more women who say they don't cook. For some, the change happens once their kids head off to college. "There is a huge mental shift when your kids are not in your home," she tells Yahoo. "There is something about children leaving home and women kind of saying, 'This is the end of my tenure in this role.'" Other women are simply burned out from accommodating picky eaters and making multiple meals for family members. But stepping away from cooking means pushing against deeply ingrained social expectations, which can be hard. There's no shortage of posts on Reddit asking, "AITA, am I the a-hole because I stopped cooking for my husband?" The frustration has also made its way into advice columns. One woman wrote to the New York Times Magazine's ethicist column, asking if she still had to cook for her husband of 35 years, adding, "I simply am not interested in food labor for another 25 years. Even when partners pitch in by grilling on an occasional Saturday night or making breakfast on Sundays, Welsh says there's a difference between weekend cooking without time constraints and the drudgery of the weeknight meal, along with the mental load of planning all of those meals day after day. Still, some families are finding ways to ease the burden that don't involve a food divorce. A 2025 Harvard study found that couples who outsource chores like food shopping and cooking, whether it's ordering food on DoorDash or getting groceries delivered, report higher levels of happiness. The freedom of not making dinner every night. Erin White, author of Like Family and mom of two who lives in Minneapolis, says that once you enter middle age and have spent years feeding everyone, it can stop being fulfilling to some. She knows that feeling firsthand. Like Donahoe, White took on the cooking because she works from home while her wife has an office job, and it was something she genuinely enjoyed for years, subscribing to Gourmet and Bon Appetit and amassing a huge cookbook collection. But once she hit her mid-40s, her passion for cooking waned. "I loved it, and then I didn't," she tells Yahoo. For a while, White joked with her wife that she was quiet quitting dinner, cooking a little less and ordering takeout a little more. When their older child left for college and only their teenage daughter was still at home, White stopped feeling tied to doing the traditional family dinner every night. Now meals are flexible. Sometimes everyone is at the table together. Sometimes people eat at different times, and family members take what they need. White says it's been kind of fun and a luxury to do dinner this way. While she still cooks occasionally, these days White focuses on low-effort meals that stretch. She'll make a big pot of soup or stew, roast a chicken a couple of times a month, or just pick up rotisserie chicken. "We always have lots of salads, canned salmon, tons of stuff to make quesadillas, and lots of eggs," she says. enough for anyone in the house to throw together a simple but relatively delicious meal. White embraced the time she got back from no longer having to prep and cook dinner. I loved being able to take an exercise class that I always wanted to try that started at 5, and knowing that we could instead just eat scrambled eggs or make burritos at 7:30, or people could eat without me, she says. As a writer, I loved that if I were really jamming on my work, I could keep going until 6:30. That was very liberating. Even though it's been 4 years since White changed up her family's dinner routine, 5:30 will roll around, and I won't be thinking about dinner. And I will be euphoric. From BuzzFeed, I was the lead singer of a legendary rock band. I kept it a secret for years. By Oscar Saville. I am sitting between my two teenage daughters at a Taylor Swift concert. From the outside, it looks like the perfect moment. A mother with her girls at the show of a lifetime, surrounded by screaming fans, dressed in costumes from every era of Taylor's musical journey. But inside, something is wrong. A kind of dread rises in me as I watch the massive clock on the stage, counting down the seconds until Taylor appears, as if her arrival and my survival are somehow linked. The truth is, I don't want to be here. I tried to get a friend to take my kids, but he insisted I go. You have to, he said. What I couldn't explain to him, even to myself, was that I was certain if I went to this concert, something terrible would happen. The clock strikes zero, and the crowd erupts. My two teenage girls turn toward me, smiling. I smile back and nod. Yep, having fun, but I'm not. A queasy cocktail of emotions explodes inside me, and the only thing I can do, short of running from the stadium, is collapse into my seat. Hidden below everyone else on their feet, cheering, dancing, and singing, I search through the gaps in the crowd like a small child looking for something that would help me understand what I was feeling. Finally, I glimpse the giant screen. There she is, bold and luminous, moving as if on top of a wave. 70,000 Swifties, her ocean, carrying her spirit across the stadium. I can't believe I gave this all up. I never dreamed of being on stage. If I had a dream, it was simply to get out of my childhood home and escape the abuse I experienced there. And if I could, help others escape too. But one night, a simple comment from a stranger changed everything. You're a singer! I was 23, and the only time I had ever let anyone hear me sing outside my childhood bedroom was the week before in that same karaoke bar in San Diego. I'm a singer? I felt elated by the man's words. It was like my purpose had finally been revealed to me. I went back to that bar every night after that. I'd pick a song from the large binder, take the mic, and stand in the dark corner underneath the stairs. There, hidden from view, I'd quietly delight in the sound of my voice, something I had never had the safety to do as a child. People began to know who I was at the bar. I could see the excitement in their eyes when I walked in. I had never been seen or wanted before. My new love loosened my fear. I stepped out from the dark, and immediately doors began to open. I received an invitation to sing with Robin Lee Messurier, Rod Stewart's guitar player, and then others. Eventually, I became the lead singer of 10,000 Maniacs in 2002. Being on stage was glorious. I felt alive, free to be me. I was celebrated for having a big voice and a big personality, attributes that offstage, as a woman, got me chastised. Being with the Maniacs was wonderful. The guys were great musicians, and Natalie Merchant had written incredible songs that gave voice to issues that too often went unaddressed in society. Child abuse, addiction, alcoholism, and teen pregnancy. I also felt I was helping people. After gigs, fans would say things like, "You changed my life," and "The way you sang that song, it really touched me," and "It's as if you knew what I had gone through." I did know exactly what they were feeling. When I would sing "What's the Matter Here," I felt empowered, like I was calling out to my mother in front of all those people and saying, "Look, Mom, you can't get me." The truth, however, was that my childhood experiences had already gotten me. The shame I carried and the belief that I had to hold it in was secretly killing me. The year I joined the Maniacs was also the year I met my husband. I had gone on a 3-month solo adventure to Ireland. I imagined traveling with my guitar and getting to know the country all by myself. But on the fourth day, he appeared. He was handsome, but he was also hurt and angry due to a prior relationship and separated from his 2 children who were living in another country. All of this drew me in. I spent the summer with him in his stone farmhouse that was built during the Irish famine and still filled with remnants of the last owner's 1950s belongings. I drank coffee from the vintage Robin's Egg Blue teacups, cooked gourmet meals on a 2-burner camping stove, hung the washing on the line while watching the cows in the pasture beyond, and climbed onto the roof to fix holes as the rain came down. It felt like we were building something new out of all that wreckage. And when he smiled and his dimple appeared and he called me his girl, I melted. One day he told me he wouldn't be able to handle it if I became too successful or well-known. This worried me, especially since I had just joined a legendary rock band. But I believed his comment came from his fear that he wouldn't be enough for me. I dismissed my worries and his and chose him. We got married in 2004 and moved to Dublin. Our first child was born in 2005. I was overjoyed. I had been waiting for her since I was 7, the age when I had promised myself that one day things would be different for my kids. I was fiercely protective, She never left my side. Even when I was on tour, a trustworthy friend would hold my daughter on the side of the stage, where she could see me singing my heart out and know I was still there for her. In 2007, on my mother's insistence, I left Dublin for a gig in Los Angeles without my daughter. My mother had come to stay with us for an extended period because she was losing her home in California. "I want to help you," she said. Despite everything she had done to me, I was desperate to believe her. I still wanted a mother. My whole childhood, I had heard her say, "It's a man's world." I had watched men belittle her, call her nasty, foolish, too much. I believed this could be our moment, and that she would cheer me on in my career. I thought together we might lift our next generation out of what she herself had never escaped. Instead, she sat at my table, praising my husband, while I placed dinner in front of her, and cut me down for wanting my daughter with me on tour. I was suddenly 6 years old again, cowering, and somehow telling myself this was love. The morning after the show in L.A., I had a strange thought. Am I pregnant? I bought a test on the way to the airport, and in a crowded bathroom, I peed on it. The two positive lines that developed looked like two roads. One led to my dream of singing, and the other led to my children. Far from my friends in the U.S., the women who might have been more like me, I was surrounded by my husband's sprawling family. His parents had been together for 40 years. He had nearly 100 cousins. I wanted my children to grow up with roots like that, not the childhood I had escaped. Besides, how could I possibly take two children on tour? I quit the band. I stopped listening to music and never spoke about it again, except when someone recognized me or I had a slip of the tongue. When people asked why I had never mentioned my former life and love, I fumbled. Truthfully, I didn't understand it myself. 6 months before leaving the band, I opened a children's clothing shop. Maybe, deep down, I had already surrendered the idea that I could have it all. As an immigrant in Ireland, I was an outsider. I spoke too openly about feelings, about the tender stories we all carry. "We don't talk about those things here," I was often told, but I knew healing only came with feeling. My shop became a kind of secret den. Women came for the beautiful clothes for their children, but they stayed for the conversations, for a place to be seen, heard, and feel safe enough to cry. I worked 6 days a week in the shop with my daughter beside me. At night, I would return home, cook, and take care of the family. I was proud of myself. I felt strong and resilient, like the Irish mothers around me. But deep inside, there was a weakness I could not undo. During the birth of my second child, my leg slipped from its socket. The pain was searing. I could not hold back the tears. "I'm sorry. I'm not strong like the Irish women," I said, begging my husband for forgiveness. 8 months later, I lost a pregnancy, and I collapsed inward. My body had failed. I felt ashamed of the feelings inside me. I was determined to pull myself together. I took my two babies to Greece in the hope that the sun and warmth would heal me. But the strain already present in my marriage grew like the continent between us. I doubled down in my efforts to fix myself and make my family whole again. In the years that followed, I became an energy healer. I lost two more pregnancies. I closed the shop. We moved across continents, searching for something I couldn't name, the thing that would fix me, fix us. We finally landed in New York City, where my son was born, in the dark silence of Hurricane Sandy, on my birthday. I threw myself into building a new life, a home, my energy healing business, a family that looked whole from the outside. But we were like that old farmhouse, built in a famine. In the wake of Donald Trump being elected president in November 2016, I began attending a friend's meditation group in hopes of finding some calm. After one of the meetings, a woman approached me and introduced herself by saying, "Hi, I'm Julie, and I'm an actress." Maybe it was the shock of the election that had me reeling, or the strangeness of this random woman announcing her profession. Whatever it was, it annoyed me. "Hi, I'm Oscar, and I'm a musician," I struck back. "That's awesome. What kind of music?" Julie asked. I was surprised to hear myself tell her about my music career. Within minutes, she said, "You should sing the national anthem at Madison Square Garden. I know someone who knows someone there." I thought she was joking, but she wasn't, and she insisted I give it a go. I finally agreed to send in a recording of myself, and then promptly forgot all about it. A few weeks later, I received a phone call from the talent booker at Madison Square Garden. "The Rangers wanted you, but I had to tell them they were 30 seconds too late. The Knicks got you first." I hung up in shock. What was going on? I felt lost. I had been away from the industry and completely hidden my past for so long that I really didn't know how to handle this. I called a friend who was not only a musician, but also the first person I had opened up to about the struggles in my life and marriage. She gently walked me through what I needed to do, step by step, and told me how to do simple things like buying a dress and trying it on, which seemed like rocket science to me. She also helped me tell my kids the secret I had never shared with them. A few weeks later, I stood in front of 20,000 Knicks fans and my three children. I could feel their pride. The mommy they had always loved and believed in was now basking in the light that they had always seen around her. I could share this part of myself that I kept locked away, and they loved me for it. And now they could brag to their friends, "My mama is a rock star." I took the mic. I felt like a genie being let out of her bottle. My voice, which I had pushed down for so long, now reverberated through the stadium, and I heard it. 6 months later, I left my husband. The ending of our relationship was messy, and it brought up all kinds of trauma from many different points in my life, including the abuse I suffered as a child. I never wanted my kids to feel even a hint of what I had experienced, so it made me determined to prioritize doing what was best for them. I didn't want to make any waves, so I reverted back to the silence I had momentarily escaped in front of the crowd at the Knicks game. That suffocating silence lasted until the night I saw Taylor, and her voice awakened me again. I now understand why I was so scared of going to that concert. I was afraid of seeing someone living the life I had given up and doing what I truly loved doing. But nothing terrible happened that night. Instead, it was like a spell was broken. As I listened to Taylor's songs and watched the way the crowd reacted to every movement she made, I felt myself, my truest self, tremble beneath all of my pain and fear. The next morning, my children circled around me and said, "You're such a good mama. Why not love yourself the way you love us?" Was it possible to love oneself? I wanted to, but I knew that I first had to confront the grief and the misery that I had avoided for so many years. With the encouragement and love of my kids, I began digging into my past, into everything that hurt, and the weaknesses I'd spent too long believing lived at the core of who I was. I prayed for the strength to feel everything I had numbed, and feel it I did. It wasn't easy. Some days I wanted to run or retreat back into silence, but I gently reminded myself that love never gives up. I knew that there was no future in trying to stand still or living with ghosts, so I continued to push forward. I began to write about what I'd been through, and several months later, I found the courage to do a one-woman show, Breaking Open, at the Edinburgh Fringe Festival. My children acted as my production crew and proudly wore T-shirts that read, "Please come to my mama's show." I have learned so many things over the past 10 years. Shrinking myself serves no one, but sharing my light does. Family isn't defined by outward appearance, only love and understanding. And most importantly, it's never too late to choose a new path, even when it feels scary. As for music, I'm standing at the edge of another beginning. I've slowly started writing new songs, and I'm letting myself dream of new musical adventures. I may not ever even front another rock band, but whatever I do, I'll be using my voice. No one will ever take that away from me again. From the New York Times, Wedding Tension, When Couples and Parents Disagree. Different generations often have different ideas over what qualifies as a must-have. By Tammy LaGorse. Sam Blake's career in wedding photography has been built partly on an ability to sense when trends in imagery are shifting. For instance, a few years ago, when the 20-somethings of Generation Z started outnumbering the 30 and up millennial couples she was shooting, Blake made a point of offering more informal pictures. "Gen Z's reject anything that feels stage or performative," said Blake, who is based in Brooklyn, of her experience. "Millennials who grew up in an era when online images were polished to perfection were more interested in curation, she added. Every generation lightly retaliates against the one that came before it. Less discussed is the balance she finds herself striking between the wishes of the marrying couple and their parents, many of whom are footing or helping to foot the bill. I feel like the mother is just as much my client as the bride, said Blake, who is increasingly shooting classic pictures for the parents in addition to playful images for the couple. Other vendors are also witnessing intergenerational tension. We're in an era of who's driving this, said Ariel Meadow Stallings, the founder of Offbeat Wed, a platform for wedding professionals. There's a real shift in terms of presumptions about who's going to have control. Much of it, according to wedding professionals, is the uptick in digital natives walking down the aisle. Since the advent of social media, vendors say the generations have become divided over what qualifies as a must-have. Blake, the photographer in Brooklyn, noted that she'll have brides who really want to express themselves with fashion, but their mothers will prefer to keep it timeless. Such brides will often tone it down for the ceremony. Then they go a bit crazy on the other outfits, she said, with reception or after-party looks. When baby boomer and Gen X parents were planning their own weddings, things were a lot more chill, said Emily Berg, a wedding planner in Northeast Ohio, referring to the absence of social media. They may have watched a high-profile wedding on television, such as the 1981 wedding of Princess Diana and Prince Charles, but they would not have expected to recreate it quite so literally. Now, she asserted, couples are looking at things on the internet they think are accessible to them that their parents think aren't accessible at all. The clash may, at times, be more values-based. The expectations of Talia Regenstein, 29, a product manager in East Williamsburg, Brooklyn, collided with those of her father, a baby boomer, when she announced her engagement in December. He was anti-wedding, she said. He thought it was ridiculous to spend a lot of money on a party. Nevertheless, he and her mother, who themselves only married in 2020 and over Zoom, were going to help pay. Regenstein's father came around when she explained that the June 2027 wedding she and her fiancé are planning near Gray Eagle, California, is not about showing off or flaunting, she said. It's about celebrating love and bringing people together. Friends' weddings, more than her occasional Pinterest and TikTok scrolls, have inspired her, she said. Weddings in our generation have so many personal elements incorporated into every piece of every little thing. I walk away feeling I know them better because of how much of themselves they put into it. Still, she and others her age have grown accustomed to the idea that when it comes to weddings, the generation gap they're likely to fall into may be hard to scrabble out of. When planning a wedding, everybody needs to expect that emotions and expectations are going to collide, said Susan Newman, a social psychologist, parenting expert, and author in New York City. That includes couples who feel their day will be a bust if their parents insist on doing the electric slide at the reception or decline to pay for a photo or confessional booth. Both sides should ask themselves, what's the most important thing, she said. The wedding is a stepping stone into a new future and a new life. You don't want to go into them argumentatively. The parents of Casey Madsen, 32, are kicking in for her January 2027 wedding in Manhattan. Masden, who lives on the Upper West Side and is a junior coordinator at Cheersy, a platform that provides day-of-wedding coordination services, has fielded her parents' guest lists and song requests. The push and pull between the older and younger generations has come into sharper focus for Madsen through her job. Several of our vendors will say, "We'll communicate with the couple only." They have that guideline in place because parents will try to join planning calls. Berg, the planner in Ohio, has yet to draw a line. "I'm doing a lot of communicating between couples and parents to make things less emotionally fraught," she said. "I always tell couples, feel free to blame me if they decide to nix a parental request. You have to live with your parents the rest of your life," she said. "I don't." And that brings us to the end of the program. I'm Mary Ellen. Thank you for joining me. And please join me again for the Women's Hour.
This is Bird Note. It's hard to think of a more lowly regarded bird than the pigeon. But as Rosemary Mosco writes in her book, A Pocket Guide to Pigeon Watching, people and pigeons go back thousands of years and were beloved by royalty. Akbar the Great, ruler of the Mughal Empire in the 16th century, kept over 20,000 pigeons.
Akbar the Great would have visiting dignitaries watch his pigeons fly around, and his hope was to sort of subdue them into awe and, you know, have them want to do business with him.
And in parts of Europe, from the Middle Ages onward, pigeon owning was a privilege.
Like in France and in the UK, you were only really allowed to have pigeons if you were a royal.
England stopped enforcing this pigeon exclusivity in the mid-1600s. But over a century later in France, peasants who built illicit pigeon houses were still being forced to destroy them. Meanwhile, the elite's pigeons were allowed to fly into peasants' fields and snack on their crops. So pigeon ownership became a flashpoint in the French Revolution.
When the poor rose up, one of the things they did was they smashed all of the pigeon houses. And the people in charge desperately passed through these measures that said that, yes, okay, the poor can keep pigeons.
Pigeons are no longer exclusive to nobility. But next time you see these birds, consider giving them a little more respect. For Bird Note, I'm Mark Bramhill.
When my dad started to lose his vision, we were worried. Sure, his doctor gave me and my mom some handouts, and I did my fair share of research. But we had no idea how much of a challenge vision loss would be or how it would impact his quality of life. That's why I was so glad we discovered Mass Commission for the Blind. They work with my dad, and they will work with you and your loved one as well to develop future plans and new skills and assistive technology. They even help Dad get access to talking books and newspapers. He was so excited.
If your loved one is blind or visually impaired, find out if they are eligible to register for services. Call 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB. That's 1-800-392-6450 or visit mass.gov/MCB.
Are you a senior who is dealing with vision loss? Would you like to learn about advocacy efforts on behalf of seniors who are blind? And about support calls where you can talk with other seniors who are also dealing with vision loss? If so, join us, the Alliance on Aging and Vision Loss, an affiliate of the American Council of the Blind. To learn more, visit our website, www.aavl-blind-seniors.org.